talk, and give me a little bit of your background and your interest in Good Black People.
Well, I grew up in Yulee.
Okay.
And the blacks and the whites, there was always, as far as I was concerned, a good relationship between them. They stayed in their neighborhood, we stayed in our neighborhood, but we crossed paths at church and school. The schools were not integrated, but my mother went to the school board in their behalf. They had a black minister from Jacksonville that drove to Yulee to preach, and his wife was a teacher and came and taught at Yulee. I don't know if she had any assistance for a long time or not, but possibly did later. They built a schoolhouse, which I don't know where they had been going to school before. My mother said, look, we have to do something for the black community because they have to be educated.
Yes.
And they built a nice little school, and that name may pop back in my mind. Right okay. Now it's gone.
Let me help you a little bit. I was talking to Frances Holliday, and she said she taught us in a small school in Yulee before she came into Fernandina to teach. And I would guess that would have to be in the 40s somewhere. I'm just guessing.
Well, I was not as well aware of what was going on with them at that time because I had my own children growing up in
sure.
school.
Uh-huh. Well, I have a question about Yulee, and pardon me, we'll just interrupt each other as
That's
we
right.
wish. I've talked to two wonderful black people who have told me that Yulee was a mean place for blacks, and I'll give you an example. One was a person who they lived in Jacksonville, and they used to come up 17 to Yulee and then across and then out to American Beach. And this lady said her father used to be sure all the kids had gone to the bathroom, there was plenty of gas in the car, everything was okay so that they could get through Yulee without having to stop because they were frightened.
What year frame are we talking about?
Well, I would think we've got to be talking about the 50s.
Not so.
Yeah, okay. I'm guessing, but anyway, this is what she told me. Now, another gentleman in town said they didn't like to go to Yulee because the people out there were mean, and he told me a story about his mother or grandmother going out there to get on a train, and I guess to go to Jacksonville, and she stopped
North and south.
I see. Well, she was probably going to Jacksonville, but she bought a piece of cheese, and the piece of cheese was a little heavier than the store owner thought it was, so he just bit a piece off and then gave it to her, and there was a tobacco juice on the cheese. He told me that story.
What kind of year was he talking about? That didn't happen in my lifetime.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was guessing about the first one that I mentioned to you, and I assumed it was in the 50s. Maybe it was later. I don't know. Was there trouble in Yulee during the civil rights period when they were...
No.
Okay.
They did not have trouble then. And this is a transcript that Alonzo Grant wrote.
Okay.
He wants it published.
I see.
And it is as good as... He named over all the white families.
Uh-huh.
He named all sorts of incidents that happened and how kind the white people were to the blacks.
Well, this is what I'm hearing most of the time from the folks that I've interviewed.
They had a bad experience.
Uh-huh.
I don't know anybody that ran a store that chewed tobacco in the first place. There's a possibility. There was a look, but it was much earlier than that.
Uh-huh.
There was a little store. And I can't even imagine, I can imagine that man doing that.
Yes.
But I'm not going to call his name.
Sure, no, that's okay.
That's okay. Too many relatives.
Yeah.
And
names don't mean anything.
It's possible that he could have done it, but
uh-huh.
the two main stores that were right there by the railroad tracks would not have done that.
I see. Okay. Well, I'm just sharing with you what I've been told, and there seems to have been...
Somehow they tell something and it magnifies.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Because there was problems between certain, well, I call them the redneck white community, and some of the blacks who were aggressive.
Could this have been maybe later in, say, the 60s when all the civil rights stuff was taking place?
No, there wasn't any way it could have happened then.
Okay. You know, back
because
in
because there wasn't any little store with a tobacco chew. I don't know any storekeeper in my lifetime in Uvie that even chewed tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
My father wouldn't sell it in his store because he did not, he would sell chewing tobacco, but he wouldn't sell cigarettes because he had teenage children and nephews and whatever.
Yeah.
He said, if it's available, they may take up smoking.
Yeah.
I will not even sell.
Yeah. I'm not sure that this fellow sold it, but he chewed it and he bit a piece off because let's say she was interested in a quarter pound, maybe it was a little more than that. And to bring it down to a quarter pound, he just bit a
piece. Well, I'm saying they didn't chew.
Yeah, okay.
Either of the stores.
Okay.
And then later there was that little store and then one down by the railroad track.
Uh-huh.
And neither one of them, not one of them chewed tobacco.
Okay.
I knew who chewed tobacco. I was a kid.
Yeah.
I knew everything that went on, black and white.
Yeah. Well, we'll
but
just leave that one.
My freedom. I was free to go and come all over Uvie from the earliest remembrance, from the time I was tiny.
Which would be roughly what year?
Well, I'm 80.
Okay, so from...
In the 20s?
20s, yes.
On,
I
was familiar with what went on. I knew everybody, black and white.
Yeah.
When we were teenagers, we liked to go to the black church because we loved to hear them sing, and they had kids our age that had a quartet. And they always had their services on Sunday afternoon.
Did you go to school with those kids, or were they separate? They were separated.
Schools were separate.
Yeah, okay.
And even when they reached high school, they brought them into Peck. And they didn't run buses for the blacks. If they were in high school and wanted further education, they'd catch a ride on some of the pulpwood trucks coming in town, or anybody that would bring them.
Yes.
There was a while that one of their black men had a car and would bring a carload. But they were pretty much on their own to get an education.
That was difficult for them, wasn't it?
It was difficult.
Now that period you're talking about when you were a little girl, Rosewood took place. Did you hear about Rosewood back when you were a child?
Not when I was a child. That was not, my mother would not have discussed anything of that nature with us.
Yes. It seems the same protection was granted the blacks, too. The mothers and fathers really didn't talk to the kids about it, except that they seemed to know their place. You know, they knew their
place.
Well,
the whites had a place, and you stayed in your place.
Yes.
Where we used to go Sunday afternoon, I remember very well the last time I went. The minister said, "Now look, we enjoy having you come. You come and you worship with us. You miss... Right in the middle of our service, when the music is over, you get up and walk out, and that disturbs the continuity. Now you either quit doing it, or you come and stay for the whole service, and I will talk to your father about it. So if you don't want me to tell him first, you tell him."
Mm-hmm. Did that solve the problem?
It did.
That's wonderful. That's good.
We knew.
Uh-huh.
We knew that he had the authority to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We knew he would do it. And we knew our father would not put up with that. Now, my father died when I was 15, so these things were happening in those early years.
Yes, yes. Did you hear about the early black slave days and so forth from your parents?
We had Aunt Polly.
Aunt Polly.
She was the daughter. She was born into slavery.
Okay.
And she was still living, and she lived over across the river in Camden County.
Okay.
But ever so often she would come to visit my mother. At Christmas she always sent us a cigar box full of Benny candy that she had made herself. She raised the Benny and had the Benny seed.
How do you spell Benny?
B-E-N-N-E.
Okay, that's a new word for me. Okay.
Well, that was what they used to call it. What do they call it now? I'll think of it in a minute.
Okay. That's
the
okay.
Sesame.
Sesame, okay. Okay.
We're called Benny.
Okay.
And she made it with a homemade syrup.
Uh-huh.
It was a syrup candy with a Benny seed.
That's wonderful. Now, what did Polly tell you about the old days when
she said that they were unusually blessed because their owners treated them like family, educated them, which was against the law.
Yes, yes.
My great-grandfather was the owner of Polly.
I see. I would assume that she probably worked in the house.
She helped raise the family,
yes.
And when my grandmother died, she helped raise 10 children, and her daughter helped. Her daughter then later, in later years.
Yeah. You know, that's exciting, and I suspect that the people in the fields had maybe a little different story because they had to work so hard.
Well, they had to work hard, but on their particular farm, they had certain rights.
And yeah, okay. What else do you remember Polly talking to you about?
Well, she always had to put in a good word about how we should behave.
Yes.
And she talked a lot about my grandmother that she loved very dearly. Okay. She'd sort of grown up with her.
I see. Now, had Polly actually been a slave and then freed, or was her...
She was born into slavery. Her mother was a slave,
okay.
And she was born into slavery sometime before the slaves were freed.
Okay.
But she... As she said, she didn't think... She was treated like a slave. She was just a person, and...
Yes.
Treated like a person.
Okay. When you knew her as a child, roughly how old do you think she was?
I didn't have a clue. She
yeah.
was just an old lady with white hair. But we had a family of Alberts that at an early age started working for us. They had a large family. I think probably 13 or 14 children eventually.
Okay.
But Paul and Bessie Albert lived up at Evergreen.
Okay.
And they brought their oldest daughter, Essie Mae, when she was 9 years old, came and lived with us, and big enough to wash dishes and
sure.
help around the house and watch the children play and play with us.
Uh-huh.
And we loved Essie Mae.
Wonderful.
She was part of the family. Then Essie Mae, after Essie Mae, we had Catherine. She married and lived there in Yulee and had a large family and were in and out.
Uh-huh.
And then Ethelie. And Ethelie's children are outstanding.
Ethelie.
They are doing all sorts of wonderful things.
E-T-H-E-L-E-E?
Ethel? No, just E-T-H-E-L.
Okay.
Lee is
okay.
separate.
L-E-E. Oh, I see. Okay.
It's Ethelie.
Okay. Okay.
Well, we saw Ethelie.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh.
One of her daughters is in St. Louis, Missouri, a trained nurse. Has 5 clinics that she manages and runs.
Isn't that wonderful? Does she come home every once in a while?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
And comes, she said, my brother and his wife, she calls my sister-in-law her second mother.
I see.
Because they helped her with her education.
Okay, okay.
And some of the other girls married ministers and were active in Jacksonville in the black community. And the younger one is the one I was talking, Ethelie's daughter, Ruth.
This is the young black lady you asked me to remind you about?
Yes.
Okay.
And it made me think. I called my sister. I said, I have to tell you this. We do things and we don't know we did them.
Yes.
Totally unaware.
Uh-huh.
It's just sort of every day. Ruth was helping. She was not very old. I'm going to guess she was around 12. And she was helping watch my children wash dishes and do light things to help me.
And this was roughly what year, just roughly?
Well, in the 40s.
Okay, okay, good.
Because my children were little, and the younger one was born in 1940. So we're talking about 40s or late, or maybe early 50s.
Oh, okay.
And she'd never been to a movie. And she was there that day, and it was a Saturday, and I said, well, Ruth, would you like to go to the movies with us? And she said, yeah. And she said, but I don't have anything to wear. And I don't remember particularly this. It's typical of what I would do then. She said, I just said, well, that's all right. I'll take care of it. And I went into the sewing machine and sewed her up a dress and put it on her, and away we went to the movies.
Bless your heart.
Well, I liked to sew, and I nearly always had
uh-huh.
something I could
uh-huh.
stitch up. But what impressed her was she had not ever been to a movie. She remembers the movie, and the movie was all right, but she said, I did not know that when we got to the movie, I would not be sitting with y'all and that I had to go upstairs in the movie house. And I didn't think a thing
yes.
about it. It was
yes.
just accepted, and that was the way it was.
Yes.
But she had not had an occasion to find it out, and it was a culture shock for her.
Yes, I imagine. Now, was that theater here in town?
Yes.
Okay, downtown.
Downtown.
Yeah, okay.
And I said, it never entered my head until she told me, and this has been recent that she told me about it, that was a real shock to her. And I'm going to presume that was the first true culture shock she had.
I would assume so, yes. Did you experience others with black people? Did you run into this kind of thing with other people? Other black people? For example, I was talking to a lady the other day that was in a, she was a black lady. She was in a store and her child had to go to the bathroom. And she had to leave the store and, as she said, go into a black neighborhood in Jacksonville before she could find a place for her child to go to the bathroom. The child didn't understand.
Well, we, at Yulee, where I lived, there at the store, of course, the toilets were outdoor when I was, when I first remember. I remember when they put, I don't know how old I was, but I remember putting the toilets in. They not only put one in for us, but they had one upstairs on the porch and one downstairs on the porch, you know, closed
yes,
in. And they could go and
fully colored.
Yeah, okay. They could go. It was not labeled black or white. If you had to go to the bathroom, you went.
That's interesting. Okay, but that was
within your... But that was not common.
Yeah, that's right. It was in your store, so you could do that. What kind of a store did you have?
General merchandise.
Okay.
My father advertised from pens to coffins.
Isn't
he sold coffins.
Yes,
we didn't have undertakers on.
Sure, okay.
If you died, they came to the store and bought a coffin that fit.
Put them in the ground.
Put them in the coffin and borrowed the store truck, got my father to haul the coffin for him. When we were little, we had two warehouses, a big one that kept feed and lots of things, horse collars, all kinds of things were in that warehouse. It was a fascinating place to play. But when they had a lot of feed, they stacked them two here and two here.
Okay.
And we liked to get up and go down in the middle until the family caught on to what we were doing. And if we pushed them a little hard and they fell over.
And you were in trouble.
They were in trouble.
Yeah. Did you play with black kids?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, sure. Just all the time.
When they came, I had two or three special black friends.
Yes, okay.
As a rule, their mothers were there to work or do something at the house and had to bring the child, so we just played.
Sure, okay, okay.
But we're still friends. We were then and still are.
Yeah. Well, can we go back to Aunt Polly for just a moment? Did you hear from other senior black people about the slave era and what kinds of things did they share with you?
Well, she was the only one that I actually personally knew that was involved in any way directly with slavery.
Okay.
Other than that, some of them, if they thought they were working too hard or whatever, would make some remark about not a slave.
Yes, okay. Okay.
The question is, do you want the job and do you want to be paid for it, or do you not? It's up to you.
Mentioning being paid, when the blacks came to your store, did they put their purchases on account, or did they usually?
Both.
Were they pretty good about paying their bills?
If they worked for the railroad, yes. If they didn't work for the railroad, you didn't know whether you'd ever get it or not.
I see. So you were more careful about letting them have too much, I guess.
You didn't. They knew not to ask for too much.
That's interesting. Okay.
They knew what they could charge. They knew what the guidelines would be. And they knew what the prospects of paying it were. And sometimes have to work it all.
Do you remember problems with blacks maybe getting into a little bit too much moonshine or...
on Saturday nights you didn't get out of the house. If you were white little girls or whatever, you stayed in the house, you stayed... We lived upstairs over the store.
Okay.
And it was a settled fact that we're going to be drinking. We knew who had the moonshine, we knew where they were, we knew where they'd be drinking. In fact, one, this SMA that I told you about that started working with us when she was a child, her husband killed his father in a drunken brawl one Saturday night.
Is it two blacks? Yeah, yes, her husband and the father, okay. How about white?
But that left her with a child to raise.
And no husband, and no grandfather.
Right.
How about the Ku Klux Klan? Were they active out your way? Did you ever see?
You would hear about it, but what you never hear about is if a white man was drinking and beating his wife and whatever, they went after them the same as they did blacks.
The Klan did.
Yeah.
That's good. That's interesting. Uh-huh. Okay. Did you ever see them marching or burning crosses or any of this?
I heard about them burning crosses, but we were protected. We would not have been allowed to see it. But the Klan would dress in all their regalia if there was a... Well, they called them revival meeting, protracted meeting, or whatever. You could almost depend on them coming on Wednesday night, and they would always bring some gift or whatever.
That was their meeting night that they got together?
I don't know what their meeting night was, but they would come to the church and make a donation if there had been a revival meeting. Okay. And they did it for blacks and whites.
I see. Okay.
But the blacks were scared to death when they'd come. And it was, as I remember, it was sort of eerie. You wanted to sort of scrunch down in your seat and what all these white-robed things coming in here, because you've been hearing them preach about hellfire and damnation.
Yes.
And here come these, wanted to just shrink down.
Yeah. I have heard blacks talk about the donations that were made, but your comment, the first one I've heard, that they gave money to the black churches too.
Yes,
which I think
did.
Is wonderful. Yeah, okay. Can you think of any other Klan stories?
No, you would hear something about where they had gone after somebody, but you wouldn't really.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we were protected from that kind of thing.
Okay. Statistics that I've read, and sometimes they don't mean anything, but indicate that Florida had as many lynchings as any other of the southern states, like Alabama, Mississippi, and so forth, which was surprising to me.
I don't think so much in this county, but down in Taylor County, in that general area, mm-hmm. it was well known that no black went through. There were certain towns they didn't even be seen in.
I see.
Daylight or dark.
Okay, yeah. This would Taylor County be close to where, say, Rosewood is, or is Rosewood in Taylor County?
I'm not sure, but Taylor County is near the Gulf.
Okay. Rosewood
Perry, Florida is in Taylor County.
Okay. Oh, yes. Okay. Very good. So it's south of Tallahassee, southeast of Tallahassee. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you remember any celebrations for the Emancipation Proclamation on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day, the blacks celebrating?
If they did, they didn't do it openly.
Okay.
Where I would know about it.
Okay. As you passed through your teenage period in life, you obviously became even more interested in the welfare of blacks. And you're a very special person, the way I understand it, because you cared about them. Can you tell me some more things that you experienced in your association with blacks?
Well, I think this one is funny. I had a black washwoman, and she was one of the South Carolina Geechee. The others called her a Geechee nigger.
Can you help me with that? I don't understand the
They were part Indian.
Okay, that.
And there's been things in the paper recently about the Gullah language and whatever. Evelina was very red, and I don't remember her husband. It was Regis and Evelina Randall, and she did my washing, and I had a niece of my husband's used to stay with. We finally adopted her, but she'd be there, and she was just rambunctious, and her clothes were torn. They were dirty all the time. There was piles of
she
them.
She played hard.
And Evelina said, "Don't you bring me any more of her clothes that dirty. You soak them out before you bring them. I'm not going to scrub my knuckles off washing her dirty clothes." She wanted me to send her back. She didn't want me to keep her.
Yes. Now, how do you spell Geechee?
G-E-E-C-H-E-E.
Okay. And that was a a nickname maybe for a black that had Indian blood?
That were from South Carolina.
South Carolina, okay. Now
they're on the islands up there still.
Okay.
And they're encroaching on their places now, and they feel very threatened, and they're not happy about it.
I see. The regular blacks, you mean, are not happy about the Geechies?
No, the whites
are
taking over the land.
I see.
Like islands, you know, and like Amelia Island has grown.
Yes.
You can imagine what they're doing off North Carolina,
yes,
coast,
okay.
South Carolina.
Now, these Geechies spoke a form of Gullah?
Yes.
That was their language?
Yes.
I need to learn more about that. That's intriguing.
It's interesting.
Yes. Now, you're familiar with the fact, maybe, that Andrew Jackson beat the Creeks up in Georgia and Alabama, and they were forced out of the area, and they came south, they came into Florida, and they became known as the Seminoles?
Some of them stayed in Georgia and remained Creeks.
Okay. Now,
and there's some of their descendants in the area around Vidalia.
Okay. Well, there must be some here in North Florida, too. That's what I was leading up to. The Seminoles and the blacks were very close. They lived together, they dug their fields together, they raised their crops, they intermarried, they fought together. And one interesting thing that I've heard is that the Indians didn't understand the English speaking language very well, but the blacks did, and the blacks learned the Indian language, so the blacks were interpreters between the Indians and the white people during the time they were going through the Seminole Wars, etc. There are known to be Seminole descendants or with black blood in them around here. Have you ever heard of any? Ever met any?
No, the only Indian that I've ever known here in the area lived out here.
Jimmy Drummond?
I don't remember his name.
Gentleman that had all the snakes? There was one lived out here somewhere around Fort Clinch or that area that used to keep an awful lot of snakes, and people were afraid to go near him because of all his snakes. And his name was Jimmy Drummond, and he claimed to have been descended from a family that intermarried with the Seminoles.
Well, he was the last Indian that I know about that was in this general area.
I see, okay.
And whether there was mixture with other people or not, I don't know.
Okay. Well, that's an area for me to dig into because it is part of the...
But you're going to hear different versions of it, because when I was in high school, I graduated here in 35. And just before right after I graduated, he died or disappeared.
Okay.
But he had dug his grave, and I saw it. He didn't show it to everybody, but there were a few of us that he trusted. And he had dug his grave. He had it fixed so that when he got ready to go, he could get in there and trip this little stick, and it would cover him up. Nobody had ever seen him. He had the top of the board covered with grass, sods.
Isn't that something?
And I have always wondered if that's really what happened.
Well, if I find out anything about that, I'll share. But that probably has to be Jimmy Drummond, who apparently died at the age of 107. And he claimed to have a lot of Indian blood in him.
Yes, but did they bury him somewhere?
That I don't know. When I find out, I'll let you.
Now, this man disappeared that I'm talking about.
I see.
Whether he was Jimmy Drummond or a relative of his or what, I don't know.
Yeah.
But before they paved all the roads and everything, I could have gone in through the old entrance and come around and showed you where it was, the general area. But it would be somewhere near where the gate is now.
Okay, the gate to the fort?
Yeah,
okay. Has to be the same person, Carolyn, I guess. That's interesting.
Well, it would seem so, but he was not there by himself. You know, there were others, or he couldn't have been there.
Yeah, that's true.
Originally.
Yes, that's true. That's true.
So I really don't know. When I was in high school, we had a project, and a couple of ladies from North Carolina came down here. They said they were genealogists. They had to catch the train out of Yulee about 9 o'clock one night, and back then the train didn't stop. You could ride to Yulee on the train. and put you out there, and you could wait then until a train came through, and if you knew how to stop it, you could flag it.
I see.
So they went over, we lived across the railroad, so they went over and visited, and they said, well, they just didn't know how they were going to do it. And Mama laughed. She said, that's all right. Carolyn can stop the train. She knows all the engineers. So I went out, took my flashlight, went to the middle of the track and did the wave that I was supposed to do, and he gave me 3 toots back, and I said, all right, get right here, and you'll stop for 1 minute.
Yep. Uh-huh.
You've got to get on the train. Don't worry about your bags. I'll throw them in the baggage car, but you ladies, get on. And she asked me for my transcript.
Isn't that something?
And I would love to have it back, but there's no way in the world to get it back
now.
Oh,
that's too bad.
But I had interviewed him.
Yes.
And it was in there.
Okay. Isn't that something? Well, maybe one day it will turn up somehow. I don't know.
Well, yeah. I met somebody not long ago with her last name, and I asked them if they knew her, and they had never heard of her.
I see. Okay.
I'm sure that I could get some information from North Carolina archives and find out where and when she died.
Yes, I suppose. How about west of Yulee, Callahan and Hilliard? Did you know any blacks out there and how they got along?
I did not personally know the blacks out in Callahan and Hilliard.
Okay.
The road that goes through, I guess it's 108, out Sand Hill area.
Okay.
I knew those blacks in that area, and that's where the Albert family lived before they moved into Yulee.
Okay. Well, I certainly will call Charles, and if I learn some things, I'll share them with you.
Well, I don't think Charles is going to tell you anything about that Albert family.
I see. Okay. Why would that be? Why would you think?
Sort of the same thing you run into. If it's over the river, it's out in the county. And this is a long time thing, and it is not going away, apparently.
Okay.
Sort of a competition. My sister used to say after she had left home that everywhere she went, the people in the county seat, the people in the county didn't always see eye to eye about anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, I need to really find some good folks out there and hear the other side, whatever it might add up to. There's a gentleman named Lovett. I was talking to Chip Oxley the other day. He remembered his last name. I've talked to him on the phone, and he lives out in Callahan. Love it.
I don't know him, but there's another black living in Callahan that there are names in this area that are the same, and I can't I can't pull it up. Mm-hmm. Names run around.
Sure, I understand.
Some of them come back.
You and I are in the same.
When I think about that one, though, I will let you know about it, because you really need to, because he can give you the background, the difference here and there.
Yes. I'm sensing that it existed, and this gentleman, Lovett, I was supposed to see this week, but he had to go to the Veterans Hospital, and I hope to see him next week. But Chip Oxley confirmed to me when I talked to him that everybody knows this gentleman. I want to say Lovett Robinson or Rasmussen or something like that. But I will call him again, and I hope to get out there. Because you're right. There is a difference. It's coming through a little bit here.
All right. With the Yulee, they lived in Yulee, or they lived out at Piney or Hero. And there was a difference in the Negroes from Piney and Hero. Now, another thing I didn't tell you about the relationship with the blacks and the store. Certain ones, if they didn't come in a certain time, they didn't have transportation, they had to walk, and they could come to the store and get their groceries, and they would be carried back home. And I remember one Christmas Eve, my brother said, you know, everybody's been in that should have been, except old John. John Stewart has not been in, so I'll just fix a box of what I think he ought to have, what I know he would buy, and I'll just take him a Christmas gift. Got out there after they closed the store around 11:30 or 12 o'clock at night.
Gracious.
Okay. So after he got out, he went out there, and John said, oh, praise the Lord, Mr. Flood, I knew you'd come. I knew you'd come.
Something, yeah. Was he ill or not?
Well, he's the first person I ever saw that had a stroke that walked. That leg, instead of it dragging, he had carved himself what he called a sling. It was wood, and it was curved so that his foot sat in it, and he'd slide that foot, take a step, slide that foot, and he lived 2 or 3 miles out.
By himself?
I think he had a wife that died before he did.
So he really was out there all alone.
Yeah, no children.
Yes, yeah. Well, and your brother kind of adopted him then, I guess.
Well, you knew who had and who didn't have. You knew what they had.
That's right.
What they could afford to do and what they couldn't.
Uh-huh.
And we sort of, it was a paternalistic sort of thing, in a sense.
It's a wonderful feeling to be able to help people like that.
But my mother was timid. My father would laugh, said she's scared of her own shadow, but just let her think she needs to talk to the county commissioners about something and she forgets it all.
Now, Carolyn, you mentioned the name of two towns to the west, and that the blacks were different out there. Can you describe for me how they were different? You knew they were different. How were they different? What was different about them?
I don't know. I guess it was just a sort of a local thing, and this, it was like little groups.
If they said something or did something, well, they must be part of that group. Is that what you mean?
Well, you knew where they lived. Yeah. You knew what they did, because there just was not that much communication was good. But I lived upstairs over the store and the post office, right across from the depot. And the railroad went both ways. You went north and south and east and west, and they crossed there.
I see. Okay.
Another thing that happened with a black that I did not, you just live the days as they come by. And after I was married and living back in Fernandina with small children, my husband had the wood yard at Container, so he worked Negroes.
Okay.
Because actually, the white men were not strong enough to hold up out there on that wood yard.
In the heat?
It was heavy work.
Yes, yes.
And he asked one of them, you know, if he had any sisters or family or whatever that we could get, because they had the current Craft Village out there then. It wasn't any distance from Old Town. And he said, yeah, he had a sister. He talked to her about it. One day we were talking and she said, you know, I had to come to work for you. I said, you didn't have to. She said, yes, I did. She said, when I found out who it was, I couldn't refuse. And I said, well, I don't know why. Tell me about it. She said, maybe you won't remember. But she said, you know, when you lived at Yearly, right across from the depot, I said, yeah. She said, one hot summer day, it was cold. They had come from Savannah to Yearly and had to wait on the train to come in here. And they would not put any heat in the black waiting room. And her grandmother was just feeling really bad, and she wanted a drink of water, and she couldn't even get a drink of water. So she said, I took my nerve. I knew I had to have it. So I went over there to that store, and they sent me upstairs. She said, I went up the front stairs. I said, well, we had back stairs too. She said, they sent me up the front stairs. And your mother came, brought water, went over there, made the station master start a fire in the heater in the white waiting room and put her in there on a bench, and then went back and got a blanket and a pillow for her.
That's a wonderful story.
And she said, I had to come.
Yes.
But what do you think about giving a drink of water and a blanket? I mean, at the time,
something a decent person would do anyway. Sure. Yeah. But well,
blacks were not accustomed to being treated that way.
Yes. Now, you mentioned a little craft village. Craft Village. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
There were 32 houses that the mill built when they came here in 37. There was not any housing. And they built 32 houses, and they were out here between Franklin and 14th, you know, where the wells are.
Yes.
In that area. Okay. In there. There were 32 houses. They had one street that ran up through it. So they faced 14th, and they faced that street on both sides.
And you call that Craft Village?
It was Craft Village.
You know, I've never heard of that.
It was only for the employees at the mill.
Would they put black employees in those houses as well?
They didn't need it.
They all lived around the area anyway.
They all had their places. And,
okay.
Strange as it may seem, if there were 50 in a house, it didn't matter. That was a little exaggeration.
Well, but I understand. Yes, they're different in that respect. Did you ever know of any problems at the mills between the blacks and whites? Can you share a little bit with me?
I'm really not sure if I ought to tell this or not, but I will tell
okay.
it. I'm not sure it ought to be publicized.
All right. Okay.
And then again, maybe it should be.
Well.
It was back in the 38. It was 1940, and it was in the early part of the year, like after February.
Mm-hmm.
I know it was after February because I had a son born in February,
okay.
and I don't know. I can't remember the exact timing
sure.
in there, but it was in that
okay.
year. Man came out of Jacksonville, a white man, to organize. There were only 10 men on the wood yard at
were
that
they,
time.
Were they all black?
10 blacks.
Yes, okay. Okay.
And my husband was, I don't remember how many whites they had then. They had another crane operator who was white. And I don't remember the numbers, but there were 10 blacks. I remember
yes,
that.
Okay.
And he was trying to organize them into a union. He and told them they weren't getting enough money. All right, an electrician who was being trained in the mill got 20 cents an hour.
This is a white electrician? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that gives you an idea what wages
the, yes,
were.
Yes, okay.
And I don't know what the men on the wood yard made, but it was a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
But they were to go on strike and get paid as much or more than these apprentices in the mill.
Yes.
Which was not feasible. But Chicago office was still in charge, and they said there will be no labor trouble. We will close the mill. It's an experiment. If we're going to have labor trouble, we'll just close it down. They had enough white men that were so delighted over having a job. Now, you're talking about 37, 38.
Yes.
40.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just been established enough, and they all had these good jobs, and they were all in debt for new cars and new homes.
Sure. The normal things.
And if the mill's going to shut down, that means all these whites are out of work. So they tried to talk them out of it. And they said, no, they weren't going on strike. So they had two picket lines. They had one on the end of 8th Street just before you get to the mill,
mm-hmm.
and they had one on 14th Street. Just before you got to the village.
Okay.
Franklin Street was not paved at that time. It was a dirt street with ruts.
Okay.
And my husband and all the white men in the village, all these houses were families. So a bunch of them got together and they were talking about it. Well, they said, let's ride down to the picket line and see if they will listen at you and maybe listen and go home. And
mm-hmm.
they went to both picket lines, and they said one picket line went home, the one near the village. They told them, you know, this is not where you ought to be, and our families can't get back to the grocery store or anything, and you're not doing yourself any good, so go home and tell those other guys over on 8th that the mill will go down. They won't even have a job, neither will any of us. Well, they wouldn't. The other line wouldn't.
8th Street wouldn't.
They would not. So the next morning, some of them sat up all night talking, deciding, what are we going to do? Are we going to let a handful of blacks throw
us out? Cause us to lose our job.
All of us lose
yeah.
this? We're not going to put up with it. So my husband was a hunter, and he had a gun rack in his car, and that shotgun was there. All these people talking about how dangerous guns are. My children didn't know the guns were dangerous. They knew they didn't touch them, and they didn't touch
them. That's
right. But that gun was nearly always loaded, but it was snapped in. The
yes.
children couldn't get
yes.
it. Now,
yes.
they could have pulled the trigger and shot it out in front of the car.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But there were 6 of the big blacks with their clubs and whatever. And my husband and Robert Allen went with him, and they wouldn't of course, let them pass. And they had quite a fight. And Rabbit's gun had a pistol. He pulled out, shoot, and it was hung up, and he had to run about a half a block to where he could find something to knock it on so he could. Mm-hmm. And my husband pulled his gun out the rack, and he hit one or two of them. I know he hit one because Dr. Lungehausen said, please don't use buckshot next time.
It's too hard to clean up.
Had a time. Yeah. Told him how many buckshot he pulled out, and that wasn't all of them.
Yes, yes.
But it was in the man's leg.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, the word got around. Because in the brunt of it, one of them jumped over on my husband. He had a bad gash up here, and he had placed right at the base of his skull that it's a miracle, the doctor said, that he didn't kill him. And broke an arm. Mm. Bent the gun barrel.
Hit him on the arm with the gun barrel.
Yeah, and bent the gun barrel. So you can imagine
he got hit, yes.
Well, because he ended up went to the doctor first. He ended up in the hospital with the infection and the thing on his head and had mm-hmm. to be operated on for it. That's not all commonly known, all the ins and outs. But that night, the village, everything was dark. Somebody came and rapped on my front, not on the door. They rapped on the floor at the front. And I turned the light on, and he said, cut that light out. Oh my Lord, what? My husband's in bed, and I had just gotten pain medication for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he had just sort of eased off to go to sleep, so I snapped the light out. And I said, well, who is it? And a cousin of mine said, Carolyn, it's Jack. We want to see Roy. I said, well, Roy's in bed, Jack. I just got him eased off. He said, I got to talk to him. He said, we're coming in there. I said, well, you wait a minute. Let me go ask him. So I told him, Roy said, let him in. I'll talk to him. Mm-hmm. And I opened the door, and he said, don't let over three of them come in. Because I had seen far enough to realize there were two or three cars out there. My front yard mm-hmm. was full of men.
Mm-hmm.
They came in and talked to him to find out who was involved, what their names were, mm-hmm. where they lived, and whatever. And I don't know what he told him because he told me to get out, not to listen.
Yes, okay.
Well, they left. That night, down here on 8th Street between, in there where it's marshy.
Yes.
Just before you get the mill, there used to be three houses in there, kind of built up on stilts.
Okay.
They burned those houses. I don't know what all else they did. The man who had come to organize them was up at the Keystone Hotel. They went, got his car and turned it upside down in the street. The sheriff, who was Cap Youngblood, said, now, this is before all this happened. He said, now, fellas, we don't want trouble, but I'm the sheriff. And even if it's my son, if I catch you doing something wrong, you go to jail. He said, that's my job, is to keep the peace. Now, I do have to make a run over to Hilliard, and I'll be gone about 45 minutes, but you can't go to Hilliard back and forth. If anybody could, Cap could have.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But he was gone when all this took place. When he came back in town, they had done that. They had a bunch of them from Jacksonville over here. They got their cars, they shot the tires out. They got some of them out and plugged their ears and said, if we ever catch you in Ferndina again, we'll kill you. All of this went on, and a lot of these people that came in that were doing it were from Camden County. They were Klansmen, any redneck you could think of.
Yes.
And I don't know but one of them that came from Camden County, but he had a big scar down his face. And I know him. I knew him later.
Uh-huh. And so in summary, these were... this was the white reaction to these black fellows who...
Yeah, they weren't going to let them do it.
Yeah, yeah.
If we have to kill you, we'll kill you.
Yeah, and the houses burned were black houses.
Yeah,
you know,
definitely. Where some of those men who were involved in this work...
Yes, at 8th Street and
14th Town was small enough, you knew who everybody was.
Yeah,
out on top of that, I was living in the village in number 19. We had a wood stove to heat with, and I couldn't get wood brought. I had these two small children, and one of the men that worked for my husband, the one that broke up the 14th Street, came to my house and cut wood and put on my
steps. This is a black man. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
He came and put wood on my porch, and so that we could keep on.
Now, after this happened, did everything settle down at the mill and everybody took care of it?
All right. What they were told, if they didn't break up those picket lines, any of them that did not go home were in danger of losing their job.
Yes, yes.
So they told my husband, you know, you can't fire them. Well, I said, no, I can't fire them, but they won't stay long.
Yes, okay. Well, I can appreciate exactly what happened there. I understand.
But the sheriff told me, whatever you do, well, now, in all of this, they shot a hole through my car.
Oh, my.
So anybody could see my car.
Yes.
And the sheriff said, don't you, he came to my house and told me, don't you leave this house without somebody with you.
Yes.
And don't leave in your car until I tell you it's okay.
Yeah.
And it was about 6 weeks before he told me
before
it was all right.
Before everything had calmed down. Yeah.
Yeah. And there was no other incident that I know of except possibly that man lost his leg.
Yeah. But I missed that. What man?
The one with all the buckshot
in
his
leg.
Oh,
yes, yes, okay.
I think he eventually lost his leg.
Yes, I see, okay. Tell me a little bit about, I've never heard the word Cap. I've heard of Youngblood, and...
Everybody called him Cap.
Did they? Okay. I've heard...
Captain.
Captain, okay.
He was Cap.
Okay, I've heard some people say... Go ahead, you're thinking about something.
Well, I think where they got the word named Captain because he had the road gangs.
Okay, okay. Well, that brings up a question. Back in the 20s and 30s, in Florida, particularly in Florida, there was something called convict leasing. And what that was is if a black person was arrested and put in jail, somebody had a lumber yard or a turpentine company or whatever, and they needed help, the sheriff or the police would lease that convict to the turpentine company or to the lumber yard, and it was called convict leasing. Did you ever hear anything about
that? Well, I wasn't in on the way that it was done, but convicts labored on the highways and everything. In this county, they worked.
Yeah.
It wasn't, if you were on that chain gang, you worked.
Okay.
And I can remember seeing them chained together working when I was a tiny child.
I remember seeing that, some of that. When I came to Alabama, I mentioned to you, in the late 40s, I traveled through Mississippi and Florida and Alabama. I can remember chain gangs out on the side of the road, chained together. And used to have a long extension behind the truck with a little wheels on it and a little place for somebody to sit down. And that's where the guard sat with his rifle.
Yeah.
And the chain gang would be working there by the side of the road or whatever. But this convict leasing was a very difficult thing for blacks because they may have been arrested for having too much to drink on Friday night or something. But once they were a prisoner, I'm not saying this happened in Fernandina, I was asking if you ever heard of it, but when they had a convict that was put in jail for something maybe wasn't really too bad, like being drunk on Friday night, the county or the city could lease that person to a company, and they'd have to work their time out in the turpentine company, and the turpentine company would pay the county.
Well, I don't doubt that happened, but I was not aware of it.
Yeah, that was called convict leasing.
Well, I know in this county they worked.
Yes, they're just road gangs.
If they went to jail, they worked.
They worked. Probably need more of that today.
If they weren't able to work,
they
were treated okay.
Yes.
They weren't mistreated if they weren't able to work. Cap could look at them and tell whether they were able to work or not.
Yes, yeah. When I said they should do more of that today, I mean whites or blacks. If they are arrested for something and going
to
be in
they
jail at our
work.
Expense, they should work. They should do
they
something.
Should work.
Yeah.
And they should be allowed a certain amount per hour, not to be paid that, but to take care of incidentals and whatever.
Yes, that's right.
He earned it, he should have it.
When did you move to Fernandina from Yulee? Roughly what?
The last time in 51.
51. Okay, and then you lived up at the mill?
Yeah, I lived in the village.
In the village.
First.
Okay.
When I came back in 52, we bought a place over on, out in Forest Hills was new, and we bought a house out there.
Okay.
But we had moved the office building from Container over on 14th Street.
I see. Okay.
And I told Roy, I said, you know, this house is so little, it's nice, it's all right, but as soon as an apartment comes vacant, let's move over.
Yes.
So we sold the house on Stanley Drive and moved into the other house, and as the apartments became vacant, we just kept them that way. Now my son and his wife live in one end with me, so
I'm
taken care of.
Well, that's nice. Did you notice any significant difference between the blacks and the whites and the way they got together in Yulee as opposed to here? Was there anything different about the relationships?
Well, there were so many more of them here. If you called one in to work extra, if something happened at the mill and we had to go out, my husband, some of them had phones and some did not. But if they needed them, my husband had just been in the hospital for surgery, and they called him and told him they had tried to get some of the men in and they wouldn't come, and what could he do about it? And he said, I'll go get them.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to drive him all through the black community at night, which really was not the place for me to be.
Yes, yes.
And we drove, and he asked them, and they said, we don't know him. No, he don't live here. Roy said, that's all right, you know him. You tell him that if he wants his job, if he's not at the mill in 30 minutes, not to come back.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, I know who you mean.
Mm-hmm, yes, okay. Okay.
So you see, there was still a fear in the black community for whites coming in.
Yes, okay. This was after this problem you told me about.
This is late. This is since we lived back over here since the 50s.
Yeah, I see. Okay. What do you know about black business areas in Fernandina? I've heard there were some around 2nd, 3rd Street, black people who ran stores and so forth.
Well, Hippard's Cafe was here for years.
Okay.
Hasn't anybody mentioned it
yes,
to you?
Yes, I have. Hipperts?
No. Hipperd.
A-R-D, okay. Hippard's Cafe. I've heard this mentioned.
Well, she served wonderful meals.
Whites and blacks?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the whites, if you wanted a meal, you call her and tell her you needed a turkey cooked a certain way, a certain time, she'd do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
There was a store right up here on 8th Street, little grocery store, and it operated on through all of the war years. Rashe Noble owned it. He was black.
Okay. How do you spell Rashe?
R-E-C-H-E.
Okay, okay. What kind of a...
He went to work at the mill.
Okay.
And the little store finally just dwindled down. As the big stores came in, the big grocery stores, his business disappeared.
Okay. Can you think of any other black businesses around town that
Of course, the funeral home.
Okay. That Baptiste? Would that be Baptiste?
Yeah.
I'd heard that the black funeral home sent the bodies to Jacksonville to be embalmed and then brought them back. Is that...
It was not that way to begin with.
Okay.
It may be that way now.
I don't know. Yeah.
But I think this point they can come over here. But sometimes it's easier to just put the body in, take it over, and bring it back.
Yes, yes, okay, okay.
But Mr. Baptiste was licensed. He could embalm body.
I see, okay, okay. Do you know anything about the little Episcopal church that was down the hill here? They used to call it the little church down the hill. It eventually was torn down.
No, I don't. I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. That that there was a little controversy over that church in the 60s. It was an old building. The city finally condemned it. The black congregation used it, and they called it the little church down the hill, and this was the big church up the hill. And the priest used to take care of the services at both churches. And eventually that building was condemned by the city, and they started to build a new church, which is the one where the parish office is down the street.
I remember that.
And then the bishop said, no, we're not going to come, we're not going to let the blacks from the Good Shepherd move over here to the new
building. They didn't allow them, and the blacks wanted it.
Yes.
They wanted their church.
Uh-huh. He combined the two.
The bishop would not allow it. And what, Miss Peabody, Governor Peabody's mother.
Oh, from Massachusetts?
Yeah.
Okay.
Came down to St. Augustine and was demonstrating down there and was put in jail.
Over this situation here?
Yeah.
Of course, there were some demonstrations in St. Augustine, civil rights demonstrations.
Yeah,
probably,
and she was part of that, and it all happened at the same time.
Okay.
It was all a part of the same.
Uh-huh. Did you know any blacks that attended that church down the hill, the Good Shepherd? Okay.
I may have, but I don't know it.
The word is that about half of them didn't mind joining St. Peter's. The other half didn't want it, and they apparently went to Macedonia or Trinity. I'm not sure where.
And probably some of them up at the Baptist Mount Zion.
Yes, yes, I guess. Okay.
Because it seems to be the largest, most flourishing church.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another question I was going to ask you, Carolyn, at the end of the Depression in the late 30s, when everybody was having trouble earning a living and taking care of themselves, a lot of black people went north to find better jobs. There were two major migrations. One was after World War I, for the same reason, went north to find jobs. And the second big black migration was in the late 30s and the early 40s. There were lots of job opportunities up there paying a lot more money than they had ever known they could earn. Do you know of blacks who went north?
Charlie Mills left. He had a job at Container.
Mm-hmm.
And he left and went north because they told him he'd have so much better job and more money and everything.
Uh-huh.
And Hannah, his wife, is my age and grew up with me, and I give her credit for my vision.
Oh?
When I was a teenager, I had red measles, and the doctor said he'd never seen but one case that looked like the pictures in the doctor book, and I was it.
Yeah.
But I nearly lost my left eye. It broke warm boric acid water and how often to do it, and she did not let me rest. She
this was
took
Hannah,
care of it.
Hannah.
Uh-huh.
Hannah Mills.
She was Hannah Mills then. She was one of the Albert family. She was Hannah Albert originally.
I see. Okay.
That Albert family worked for us, the oldest one, Esme, Ethelie, Melanie's, Bernice, Hannah, Maggie.
Gracious, big family.
All of them worked for us.
Okay.
They'd start out with my mother, she'd get them trained, and they'd go on to a better job.
Okay.
And they were all excellent cooks, and they all married well.
I see. Now, Mr. Mills, did Carl Mills, is that what you called him?
Charlie.
Charlie Mills went north. Did Hannah go with him?
Yes. She's still there.
Oh, they stayed up north. Okay.
Yeah, they're still there. Hannah said she wishes she was back down here, but her family is up there, her children and whatever.
Did you ever hear from them as to how satisfied they were when they got up there? Did they find decent jobs?
Well, not like they had anticipated. Hannah said it was so different. It was not what they had. She said it was not the utopia they told her it would be. She said living in Philadelphia slums certainly didn't compare to living in Yulee.
Yes, yes.
It was far better.
There were difficult times in Philadelphia during the 60s. I know that. Yeah, okay.
Well, she, of course, is nearly blind at this point in time and is getting services there. I told her, I said, Hannah, they're out there for you. Tell Gertrude to get them. I don't know how.
Yes.
Because
yes.
I'm not there.
Bless your heart.
But she's getting the services she ought to have.
Yeah, okay. Did you know of other blacks that went north, and what kinds of experiences did they have?
Well, I can't think of any in particular. One of Hannah's older sisters went with some of the Carnegie family north, and she would go seasonally. And they wanted her to go back. She quit. She said, "No, I'll never go back up there. Yes. You don't have enough money to pay me to go back up there."
So it was not all it was cracked up to be.
And she says, here she's a person.
Yes.
There she was a servant.
Yes. Okay.
And she wanted to get away from that.
Yeah. Okay.
And she did. She married a minister in Jacksonville and had a nice, wonderful life over there.
Wonderful. Good. Do you think Hannah will ever have a chance to come back for a visit?
Oh, she comes for a visit.
Oh, she does?
Oh, yes.
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 Oh, that's wonderful.
They have a family reunion every year, and they have done a marvelous job of tracing their history.
Would this be the Mills family or the Albert family?
Albert.
Albert family. Well, I must find Charles and talk with him. You've encouraged me to do that.
Well, I don't know if he's part of it or if he's not.
Well, I'll
I have asked him, and he says not to his knowledge.
I see.
Sort of like, don't even suggest it. Yeah. I've been mayor of Fernandina Beach.
I can understand that, too. Well, as we close up here, Carolyn, can you think of anything else that involves blacks and their history that we haven't talked about that you think you might like to share with me?
Not the way back history. I can't think of anything except that the relationships in the Yulee area, no matter what you've heard from
yes.
outside, and I want you to read this.
I would like to.
It gives you a good clear picture of what was going on in Yulee.
Okay. Well, I'm pleased.
From a black perspective.
Yes, and that's what I'm
it's
looking
for. It's pretty accurate.
Yes, wonderful. Well, that's what I'm looking for, because that's what my work is all about, to find out what the blacks thought, how they lived, how they interfaced with the whites, what their excitement was, what their challenges were, and what their sadnesses were.
Well, some of them from that area have been in the school system in the county and have gone and retired from the system.
Yes.
And they came out of the Yulee early years.
Okay.
I can't think of that Baptist black minister's wife, and she hasn't been dead but about a year and a half. I saw her out at the nursing home some.
I see. Okay. Well, I did mention to you that Frances Holliday taught in Yulee. And she said a small black school. Now, I don't know how many there were out there.
That was all.
Okay. Well, she was out there until they integrated the schools in here, and then she became a teacher in the integrated system in Fernandina. So I'm sure you have met her somewhere.
Well, back through the early years, we always went to their graduations, their special programs, any event. They always invited the whites,
mm-hmm.
and we went.
Well, wonderful.
And they came and good. Worshiped on not every Sunday on our regular worship service, but if there was any special service, they came and worshiped with us.
Well, you're a very special person, and I know this has been a
joy. I don't know how special I am.
Well, you paid attention to people who needed help.
Well, I still do.
Yes, and I do.
And I always will, I guess, as long as I'm able.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Okay, I'm going to turn this off now. This is about Fred Higginbotham, okay?
He had a black man that rode around with him, drove him here, there, and yonder.
Okay.
And he was known to drink, so the black man would drive him. And he took him out one Saturday, I think it was, drove him around all day, all night. And the car broke down, and he got out, Fred did, bammed on the car a time or two. And I can't remember the colored man's name, it'll pop back later, but it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
He hit him in the back of the head, killed him.
The colored man?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But nothing was done.
Yeah.
There were no charges.
Yeah.
It was just another black.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he happened to be one who didn't have a big... He didn't have a wife and children and a family of that nature. He had
yeah.
family, of course.
Yeah. The black, you're saying, yes. Yes. But was that Higginbotham related to Jimmy and the other... Well, obviously, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, okay.
I won't tell you what, and I won't tell you who all else they're related to, because this is not something people talk about
okay.
anymore.
That's okay. Well, listen, I...
Off the record, I'll tell you.
It was about Spider, okay.
He was about 5 years old.
Okay.
He came in the store. My father, at that point in time, was diabetic and also had cancer, but didn't know it.
Didn't know.
But just didn't feel well.
Okay.
And so he asked Spider if he didn't want to come work in the yard with him. And 5 years old, okay?
Okay.
And he said, "What's your name?" And Spider had a high little voice, and he said, Iris.
Iris.
Papa thought, he said, did you say Spider? Well, that tickled the little black boy. So he was Spider from then on. His name was Horace.
Horace.
But anyhow, he went to work for Papa in the yard. And when he was hungry, he would go in the back door to the kitchen. And in the wintertime, he kept the wood piled by the kitchen stove, the wood box piled high.
Yes,
when he got that piled up, he was allowed to sit there and stay warm. And right out in the hall was a bookcase. And if he washed his hands, he could take any book he wanted to out and read it and put it back. And he grew up in our backyard.
Yes,
that's
sir.
The way we call it, an inside. And through the years, and when World War II came along, Spider was drafted, and he went, he fought in the war, and we have letters where he wrote to my mother. He didn't write to his mother.
He wrote to you.
Wrote to Mama.
Yeah.
And after he came out of the war, he was a railway mail clerk for a long time, then he was head of two or three different postal areas in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And stayed there and raised his family, and his wife came down and she asked his mother, why is Horace different from the rest of your children? She said, Miss Jane raised him.
That's wonderful, and great compliment to your mother, too.
But he came to see me. Well, Papa died then when Spider was just a kid.
I see.
But this kept up through the years. He'd come by to get his lunch money or his lunch or school book money or whatever he needed on the way to school. When he came in the afternoon, he filled the wood box, read a while, rested, waited till after supper, then he went down the railroad home. But he started every day asking for a little can of evaporated milk. And Mama said, well, Spider, what are you doing with that milk? Well, we need it at home. And Mama couldn't understand why. She kept this up for a while. Finally, she asked Ida, Spider's mother, what does Spider do with the milk he has to have every day? She said, oh, that's for that baby my sister's raising. She don't have no income.
Isn't that wonderful?
So we were furnishing milk for a baby and
didn't know the baby was there. Didn't know it. These are what I refer to as the common fundamental things of life. You know, just basic stuff.
He came when my husband, the last month or two that he was living, he came to see him and spent a day just sitting and talking back about what we used to do.
Isn't that
and
wonderful?
How, what a good shot he was in service. And they asked him where he learned to shoot, and he told them a white man taught him. They said, we don't believe it, you grew up in the South.
Yeah, isn't that something?
But he had won all kind of medals. But one of the things, my husband used to target practice all the time, and it scares me to death now to think about it, but Spider would hold, you know, these long matches.
Yes.
He'd hold one in his teeth, my husband shoot the end and strike the match.
Yeah, that would scare me too.
It didn't scare me then.
Yeah, well, because you knew how good your husband was.
And I knew Spider wouldn't move.
Yeah. And that's something.
I said, well, how could you?
That's a great story.
But we're still in touch with Spider.
Wonderful. I'm so pleased.